Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 5th of November 2017. My name is T.R.P. Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Nick from Party of Obstructed View, Franco Malazzo, Alice from Traffic Light Theatre Goer and Johnny Fox.
We're now going to talk about Beginning at the Dorfman Theatre. This is a new play by David Eldridge, directed by Polly Findlay with a design by Fly Davis. It has to be said, I saw one tweeter saying that they liked the precision of the design, having to put out even bits of fluff onto the stage here. It stars Justine Mitchell as Laura and Sam Troughton as Danny. We are at a housewarming party and Danny's the only person left and Laura perhaps wants to speak to Danny. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
I've always thought David Eldridge's work was a bit inconsistent, and I think we're going through an extraordinary year for new writing this year. You know, we've had gems from all sorts of playwrights, Mike Bartlett and Richard Bean and Jez Butterworth and James Graham and so on, and the ladies, Lucy Kirkwood and Nina Raine. And on this occasion, David Eldridge has delivered. The last time he delivered for me was in Basildon at the Royal Court. And I think that he seems to be better when he's writing from experience, when he's kind of writing. And so I suspect we've got something here that might be writing from experience. The irony for me is that, you know, this is very much a middle class play. And he's therefore produced the least plausible middle-class play, which is Not of the Heart, and the most plausible middle-class play, which is this, because I think it really is, well, superb. As you say, it's the sort of fag end of a party. It's the early hours of Sunday morning, and we just got the host, Laura, and this guest, Danny. She doesn't really know Danny because he's been brought by another guest who is a client of hers who she does know, and they're the last two people standing. And the reason they're there is because there is clearly a mutual attraction between them. And he's quite damaged. You know, he was deserted by his dad, divorced from his wife, estranged from his daughter, and he's very lonely, and he's socially very clumsy. And she's very successful, very independent, but she doesn't have a family. She's also lonely. But in terms of their interaction, she's very frank and very forward and very direct, which is quite difficult for Danny. So they're effectively playing out the first 100 minutes of their relationship in real time. And the play is mostly, I think, about loneliness and relationships. But there's a lot of other themes going in there, you know, around fathers' rights and some women's desperation for children, kind of how the internet and the modern dating methods has affected how relationships unfold. It's a very intimate play and it's very voyeuristic to watch in a way, even though the space, the stage space, is actually quite enormous for a two-character play. But it actually isn't uncomfortable. And I think that's largely to do with the fact that the characters are really very well-drawn characters, but the performances are absolutely wonderful. And both Justine Mitchell and Sam Troughton are, in my view, stunning. I was particularly taken by Sam Troughton because he manages to capture a very complex kind of combination of emotions and vulnerability in Danny, but that's to take nothing away from Justine Mitchell. I think that's a sort of a more complex role to grasp, really. It's all beautifully done by Polly Findlay. I really liked this huge set, which was both kitchen and large living room and a bit of a hallway, after a party with all the detritus of a party there. So on this occasion, David Eldridge, for me, has delivered, and it's one of probably 10 great plays I've seen this year. So it's, for me, it's a great year for new writing and possibly even a golden age for playwriting. And I think what's happening in the world is helping playwrights in a way. You know, I think a lot of things are happening in society and politics are actually giving playwrights really meaty things to write about. And I enjoyed this very much indeed. So, Nick, what did you think?
Yeah, I'm pretty much in agreement with everything there. I think that Danny is maybe a better written character than Laura, which I think is why Sam Troughton has a bit of an advantage over Justine Mitchell. He is the one you kind of come out remembering more. And I think in something that there's sort of some revelations about Laura's motivations that I thought were pretty predictable and pretty kind of overused. And I know that a few women have kind of found that her reasons, her ultimate reasons behind keeping Danny behind at the party, to be a bit sort of stereotypical and maybe a bit patronising towards sort of middle-aged women, without actually trying to, you know, say what it is, because I think I do. Apart from kind of that really one reservation, I hugely recommend it as well. And I do think it's not a play with a lot of story. It's a play with all the enjoyment in it is finding out kind of the layers of these people and how you get to know them. And I think that's really where its kind of success is that I think it kind of kicks off right out of the gate with the very sort of funny opening scene. And I think even though it gets more serious, I think it's always got that sort of romantic comedy element stays with it, but it does just kind of get deeper and richer as it goes through. I think it's one of those shows where you really kind of feel that the audience are with you on how much they're getting into it and how much they're enjoying it. I think you can sometimes you can really feel an audience absolutely sucked into something, and this was really one of those occasions. It looks like it's mostly sold out, which I think is, you know, I think it deserves to be.
I have to say, I found the beginning of this rather awkward. Their relationship is incredibly awkward, and I was actually slightly relieved that they didn't have an interval, because I had horrible visions of people saying that they can't really take the awkwardness that Danny shows. I mean, it is largely Danny who's so awkward in the interactions, but they're both a little bit awkward in the interactions, although Laura always seems to be knowing what she wants, and I can see what Nick means by it is a bit stereotypical and is a bit expected. I found the beginning incredibly awkward, but that is part of the point of the play, that you have to work through this awkwardness in order to reveal more about the characters, in order to get people to the end point of the play. And we are rather lucky that we don't have an interval where people goes, well, where people might think to themselves, well, I don't want to spend more time with these people being awkward at each other, but allowing you to work all the way through in one go. And of course, it is entirely real-time play, so we are working through all the awkwardness into the much richer stuff that happens towards the end of the play, and the much richer characterizations that happen towards the original at the end of the play. It is useful to get through the awkwardness, but I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it at all to begin with. And it's not because the writing's bad or anything like that. It's because I personally don't like to feel things like that. I don't enjoy comedy where somebody is, you know, feeling awkward and out of place, because I don't find that funny. I spend a lot of my life feeling like that. So it's something I recognised and something I don't enjoy. I don't enjoy watching it, and I don't enjoy experiencing it. So it was a little bit difficult for me to start off with. But I think once it gets past that, and once we get into the more deeper stuff, it's much more interesting and much more worthwhile. And it feels really rather good. We're now going to talk about The Seagull at the Lyric Hammersmith. This is Anton Chekhov's play in a new version by Simon Stevens. It is directed by Sean Holmes with a design by Jaime Shin. It stars Leslie Sharp as Irina, with Nicholas Tennant as her brother Peter, Nicholas Greaves as Boris Trigorin, her boyfriend. We have Brian Vernell as Constantine, Adeleo Adedeo as Nina, and then we also have Cheryl Skeet, Raphael Sorolle, Michelle Austin, Paul Higgins, Lloyd Hutchinson, and Lloyd Cooney. It's an extremely good cast, I think, and some favourite actors in there. I mean, Paul Higgins, Lloyd Hutchinson, Michelle Austin, Nicholas Tennant, I've sort of put a star next to, and of course, Leslie Sharp. So it's a really good-looking cast. We have a contemporary-ish translation by Simon Stevens. I think what I found remarkable about this translation, I've seen a couple of contemporary translations before, fairly recently, and the difference between this one and the others is that although the language is modern, they could have actually played it in the early 20th century dress. You know, they could have set it there if they'd wanted to. We actually have a much more contemporary setting. Nick, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Yeah, well, it is very Sean Holmes, the production. It is very overtly theatrical, and I think that's really what the setting is kind of doing. It is kind of contemporary, but kind of vague, and I think that's part of what Simon Stevens is doing as well. Is I think one thing that's noticeable is that some of the names have been anglicised, and some of them haven't. You certainly don't get the patronymics that you kind of associate with Chekhov, but also some of the names have been turned into English names, and some of them are very specifically Russian still. It's all part of Sean Holmes' kind of Brechtian aesthetic that he's got and the sort of very kind of in-your-face theatricality about it, which I think he's not yet kind of bored me with doing everything the same way. I think there's a through line to his productions, but they do still feel like they've got their own identity. I don't know how much longer he can carry that off, but for the moment, I think he is. The one thing that's interesting about it is that you get these moments of kind of soliloquy or kind of speaking to the audience, which I think it makes you realise how much of that there is in Chekhov, but it's not kind of played really as asides to the audience. It's kind of people muttering to themselves, or you're not entirely sure whether they're talking to themselves or who they're talking to. And I think this kind of really puts on the surface that these are people doing their internal monologue externally. I think even though the kind of extreme naturalism that is kind of the cliche with Chekhov, I don't think we actually see that often anymore. But I think that is something that I've not seen really picked up on as and done differently. So I think that's one thing that stands out. I think it's also a production where kind of characters who you don't normally notice as much really get in the foreground. I'm thinking particularly of, I assume it's usually Pauline, or it's Pauline here, and that's Michelle Austin. And she really kind of, I think it's largely the performance rather than the way it's been written. I don't think she's been given more to do necessarily, but I think she feels like a very strong presence there. And there's this great scene where her husband, who's kind of the sort of windbag, who's always talking about some famous actor he once saw, is wistfully remembering seeing this great actor perform, and he's amazed at the fact that he can just turn on tears on stage. And then, like a few feet away from him, he's oblivious to his wife doing exactly that. And I like the way that works on multiple levels. It works on a level of, you know, him missing his wife, shedding real tears, and also the fact that he's talking about an actor crying on command, and there's an actor crying on command right there on stage. So I think it's a good Chekhov to go with this approach for, I think, because it obviously starts with the play and there's a major character who is in theatre and there's a lot of discussion of theatre. I think it works well for this sort of meta-theatrical kind of look. I think sometimes it takes it too far. I'm thinking particularly of the scene changes where there's kind of a really nice idea of putting a curtain down and then turning it into a sort of a shadow show. But I think they've maybe thought that was a bit more entertaining than it actually is, and they kind of felt free to have incredibly lengthy scene changes with kind of very irritatingly repetitive music playing over it. And the second time it came around, I was really testing my patience. You've got Leslie Sharp is obviously the star name as Irina, usually known as Arkadina, and again, she's an interesting performance. I think, well, I went with someone who hadn't seen The Seagull before, and he felt like she, right straight out of the gates, was pretty horrific and monstrous. I, maybe comparing her to lots of other performances, found her to build up a bit more and more subtly kind of show you quite how self-absorbed she is. There's this little very kind of believable thing that she does where she'll break into a different accent every so often just to make sure nobody around forgets how wonderful her range is. And that felt very realistic to me. That felt like something a very self-obsessed actress would do in her private life. And so I thought it was a good performance. I liked Brian Vernal as well. He, again, gives something a bit different. There's a real sort of cocky front to his Constantine in the opening. So I think very often he's played with all his sort of insecurities right out there from the start. And I think here you could be mistaken for thinking he was a lot stronger than he actually is. And you get to see how that's kind of chipped away and the reality of what he is underneath that and his insecurity and how much his mother kind of causes that and chips away at him. And also, I think there's a real feeling at kind of the ending. Again, there's kind of one of those really memorable moments where Leslie Sharp is kind of grabbing at her stomach as if she's only just kind of, when it's too late, realised the connection between her and her son. So I think it's not a production that entirely holds together. It's hit and miss, basically, but I think it's more hit than miss. I overall enjoy it. I mean, I do really like The Seagull is by a long way my favourite Chekhov. I think it's the best argument for me that Chekhov wasn't actually being sarcastic when he called his plays comedies. think it genuinely is very funny a lot of the time, and this is funny production. It does find where that kind of sort of family sitcom humour that turns into something a lot darker and nastier is. So I think it's effective in a lot of ways. It's a bit indulgent in others, so it's not kind of one of the best ones I've seen, but it's certainly got a lot that's interesting about it. Franco, what do you think?
Coming back to her final point, the play itself is incredibly indulgent. I mean, Chekhov described it himself as a great deal of conversation about literature, little action, tons of love. He wanted to get out there a lot of about what he felt as a writer, expressing it through different viewpoints, through, as we can see, through a number of different characters, different viewpoints, that how one could be obsessed, how one can find it very difficult to get success and sometimes often completely fail. And this comes back to Sean Holmes, a point you didn't make, but when he first came into the Lyric, he pointedly said, I told the job, if I got the board, then the writer would come back into this building. Now, ideally, he would have liked to have new writers pretty much every week, but through things like The Seagull, you can see that he's expressing the way that, you know, the writer is so important to what we see as theatre. He doesn't often get to be put front of stage. He very rarely gets applauded, but the writer is, maybe in Sean's view, the most important part of the production. So there's that which came through. Basically, this is a very, like I say, it's a very Sean Holmesian thing. The Brechtian bit, yes. I love the way they had the asides to the audience. I love the way they brought the audience into the story. A little in-joke here and there. In terms of the casting, I thought it was very interesting that, yes, Leslie Sharp is the big name here. But I thought that the more of the side characters did a lot better. Brian Vernal, fantastic. As an emo Constantine. Just, you know, going from skulky to brash to arrogant, always having that bit of sensitivity at his heart. And I just love seeing that. He brought it out very well. Nicholas Tennant, in a role that usually gets, you know, passed by, but he gave it a lot of power, a lot of passion, especially towards the end, and to very great comedic effect. But for me, the star was Adelio Adadeo, which I think should be given a musical, a bio musical, just based on that name. It's a great name. Normally just seen on Channel 4 in some girls, but here really brought it out. Fantastic performance. Really dug deep to get out Nina's situation. The set design, I kind of like the set design. It was quite bare. The use of light was great. And the shadows, that was fine. I thought they could have been a bit more ambitious given that the Lyric is a fantastic theatre. There is a lot more potential for what they could have done there. The casting was interesting in terms of having Nicholas Gleeves and Leslie shot opposite each other. Or off stage are husband and wife. So when you get to that very intense, I hesitate to say the word erotic, but maybe sexual scene, when Leslie's trying to seduce her co-star, that adds a little frisson there, thinking, you know, is this something which carries on off stage, on stage? But it was an amazing part to think that, you know, this is a real husband and wife getting it together on stage. Actually, as a play, I thought it worked quite well. It's had a number of translations. It's had a number of different takes on it. But I thought this was quite a good one. Whether it needs new translations every year, I'm not entirely sure. This didn't really add so much to the ones I've seen before. Yeah, like I say, there was a few like touches, like making the names a bit more anglicised, but I didn't think it added a whole lot more to the stuff I've seen before.
I think it was a deliberate thing of anglicising some and not others. I think it was part of the sort of, you know, Brechtian thing of making you very aware that this was a play and it was written in a different language than the one it was in now, but I think it was a distancing thing.
Perhaps, but did it add much to the production as a whole?
Oh, not particularly, no. I think it was just part of the effect of it. I mean, to be honest, I think until you kind of accept that maybe that's what they're trying to do, I actually found it a bit distracting. You know, you're kind of going either make everybody English or everybody Russian. Mm. But in retrospect, I think it was more of a thing of, well, we don't want to say this is in Russia and we don't want to say this isn't in Russia. We're saying this is on a stage.
When I felt through things like costume, they were trying to bring it into 1920s, 1930s England or somewhere European at least. But that never really came across that strongly other than through costume and maybe the anglicisations.
Like I say, I think deliberate vagueness is very much the theme there with this. And that, I mean, that would make sense with what Sean Holmes likes to do.
I agree.
I'm still not kind of going into his productions feeling like I've seen it all before. I feel like there's a through line, but it's not necessarily a copycat. I mean, it's not like I feel like I've seen Deborah Warner do three identical productions with just different scripts in it. You know, I've walked into three different theatres to find workers noisily putting the set together, and this isn't like that. I think, you know, every time you kind of see what he likes to do, but there's not just a single aesthetic. But yeah, I thought it was generally a decent one. Not the best one I've seen, but had a lot of kind of interesting points. I think Adelaide Adedayo was... She's a very good Nina. I think what maybe didn't stand out for me was I didn't feel like I got a different Nina than I usually get, whereas I think I got a slightly different... Certainly a different Constantine.
I find it difficult maybe to compare different actors and different roles. Just to say that for this performance, I thought that she really brought it to the audience. And she stood as high as anybody else on that stage, including people like Paul Higgins, Leslie Sharp, who have got decades more experience than her. She did not look out of place.
One thing I think I mentioned actually in my review was that you don't always get from Nina, and you certainly got from her, was there's a reason it's called The Seagull. You know, I mean, it could be named... You know what I mean? It could be named after half a dozen characters, but she's referred to as the Seagull, and you kind of see why she's the person that the play's named after, because she's the one you really see an absolute trajectory of. Her kind of confidence at the start is genuine. It's not like Constantine's, which is a front. You see her genuinely broken down from someone very strong into nothing, and I think that was very strong in her performance and very kind of clear in her performance.
We're now going to talk about Young Frankenstein at the Garrick Theatre. This is a version of Mel Brooks' classic film, brought to us courtesy of music and lyrics by Mel Brooks, with a book by Thomas Meehan and Mel Brooks. It's directed and choreographed by Susan Stroman. It has, of course, run on Broadway. It stars Hadley Fraser as Young Frankenstein, with Leslie Joseph, Ross Noble, Diane Pilkington and Summer Stralin, among many others. It is, after all, a musical, so it's got a big cast. Gareth, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, the film is now 43 years old. I mean, it's a 1974 film, and actually it was on Broadway as a musical 10 years ago, so it's actually taken quite some time to cross the Atlantic. And I'm told that it's been improved and rewritten, though I wouldn't know that because I never saw it on Broadway. It's actually quite a small scale for a musical. I mean, you say big cast, but actually, as musicals go, and if you compare it with his other musical, The Producers, it's on a significantly smaller scale, which is probably why it's in the Garrick Theatre. So it's actually not as big a cast. I don't know how big the band is, because we don't see the band. There's no orchestra pit in the Garrick. But it's not the sort of normal scale of a West End musical. And I think, in a way, that works in its favour, because it's a bit more intimate, and therefore you feel you're sharing a joke with your chums, really. It feels a more intimate experience, and I think in some ways that kind of adds to the experience of the event. Mel Brooks, of course, whether we're talking films or stage musicals, would never win any awards for subtlety. He also wouldn't win any awards for sophistication or political correctness. If you go along for this show looking for any of those three things, then don't go, I think, is the answer to that. But when it comes to just big laughs and just fun, for me, I think he's quite unbeatable, really. And he's taken the Frankenstein story and, you know, it's louder, brasher, cheekier, ruder than you've ever seen the story before. And it's a sort of, well, I don't really need to talk about the Frankenstein story, I don't think. The songs are not wonderful. You won't really remember them, I don't think. But they probably will be remembered more for how they sort of come out of the story, which I thought they're quite clever the way they come out of the story. And that's probably more how you'd remember them than you'd remember them for the songs themselves. There are masses of sight gags. And they're not always new, but they're always funny. And the design is very old school. The design is all sort of screens and flats. And in a way, they kind of make a virtue out of that. The performances, you know, very broad, but you have to say executed, you know, to perfection, really. I went for a laugh. I had a huge laugh. The smile didn't leave my face the whole time I was there. The friend I went with absolutely adored it. So, you know, I just think it's just a kind of antidote to everything else, really. It's just harmless fun. And it's hard, well, for me, very hard to dislike, unless you are looking for subtlety, sophistication or political correctness. When it comes to performances, Hadley Fraser, who's Frankenstein, I've seen him in quite a few shows, but for me, this is a career high of his, because he's got an incredible twinkle in his eyes, very athletic. He does have fine vocals, as we've always known, but he also has great comic timing, and those four things added together make him absolutely perfect for the role. Ross Noble, of course, even though he has done, I think he did The Producers as Franz Liebkind, the Nazi in The Producers. But other than that, he's obviously known for stand-up. And I think
well, I mean, if he moves into musical theatre, that's musical theatre's game, because I thought he was really quite a revelation as the Hunchback Igor. And again, very athletic, sort of jumping up, you know, from floor to table. Leslie Joseph is, I would call her popular casting. I mean, she had quite a big round of applause at the end of the evening as Frau Blücher, but I thought she was okay, but she wasn't shining like the other two for me. You mentioned that we have Astralin, which is, as we know, no mandatory. But what was interesting about her performance this time, you know, we're used to fine vocal performances, but actually she delivers the comic goods here, which I'm not sure I've seen her do before. And Diane Pilkington, who plays Frankenstein's fiancée, is someone I don't think I've seen much of, really. But again, you know, she was terrific in that role as well. There's a great monster, Shula Hensley. And then we have a guy called Patrick Clancy, who's doubling up as both the inspector and the hermit. And I actually didn't know he doubled up until the curtain call, where he cleverly shows how he was doubling up. So it is a very good cast, and they're obviously having a lot of fun. I mean, it's, you know, it's quite infectious, really. And I think because of that, you kind of go with them in a way. I know some people find it crude, some people find it corny, some people find it tacky. But for me, it's just, yes, it's all of those things, but it's also, I think, incredibly funny. Alice, what did you think?
I'm still laughing. I mean, you know, it's like the old adage about television. If you don't want to watch it, switch off. I mean, most people know what to expect with Mel Brooks. They've got a rough idea from other films, productions. And if they haven't seen those, they've seen him on chat shows. They know what he's like. I think Young Frankenstein is part of a genre of putting, of course, very beloved movies on stage. And I think it works. In some ways, it is a bit of an odd reanimated creature in itself. You know, the audience goes along and there's a guaranteed store of goodwill from the fans. And I think a fair amount of newbies will enjoy the belly laugh. I suppose one could call it an adult pantomime. It's a bit different from the film in that it's now out of the context of those times. I think at the time that the film was made, it really was looking back to the making of Frankenstein, and the idea that these Jewish moguls from bits of Eastern and Europe and Germany had gone to Hollywood, were doing these movies. I think the original movie, all the village extras were Mexican. You know, and there was that the feel about the actual making of the movie of Frankenstein. You don't have to have that now. You know, I mean, it's not something which is current in people's minds. And as I say, this is more of an adult pantomime. It is a bit about Hollywood, one has to say. There is an edge to it. There have been a few criticisms from people who I think, as you've said, were kind of looking to criticize. But at the same time, I think they're slightly misguided because he was, you know, some of the things which are, I seem a little bit off colour now, are reflections of Hollywood, and they're done to be that while having a dose of really good visual, and it's cheesy, yes, but it's very slick. It's very well done, and I think it's another ace out of the sleeve of Susan Stroman, the director, choreographer, who really knows what she's doing. I totally agree with you about Ross Noble. I mean, I didn't know he'd been in The Producers, but I was very, very impressed by his performance as Igor, and I kind of like the little phrase, which I know comes from the film, where he says, "My grandfather worked for your grandfather." It sounded like it was about the founding of Hollywood and who made it and who didn't. And again, yes, Summer Stralin, who's this Swedish blonde in the middle of Transylvania, is the lab assistant. And it's all very well done. There's a very cleverly animated roll in the hay, and a lot of high kicks from her as well. Leslie Joseph did fine in the part. In a way, she had to put on this cod Transylvanian come German accent. And every time she entered, it was kind of like, and with her keynote song, "He Was My Boyfriend," it was like a kind of Beethoven Fifth Symphony roll of thunder. And you have a really rumbustious, rollicking tale, which does stand up now. And because it's so precisely done, it is a bit of a nostalgia fest in a way, but as I've said, it is different from the film and it's well adapted. I agree that it is quite small scale and intimate. And it's, of course, very, very cartoonish, which reflects, of course, the film itself, which I suppose as well was storyboarded. But it is very much like a cartoon. But all the better for that, you know, it's very well done. I think there's a lot to enjoy. It's very well choreographed, a terrific ensemble, terrific swing. It's just so well done. I think you'd be a really mean old codger if you didn't raise at least a grin. And I sometimes kind of kick myself for laughing at some of the jokes. And there is something very mildly reheated about it all. But it's so well done. As well, I would have to mention Diane Pilkington as Elizabeth. I think she was tremendous as well. And she's one of those actresses, I think maybe, I hadn't actually seen her before, I don't think, but that you take for granted because they are so good. She played Baron Frankenstein's fiance. I think it's so corny. I mean, Mel Brooks started off on sketch shows of an American comedian in the 1950s called Sid Caesar. And you just feel like, well, maybe there was a sketch which they discarded on the Sid Caesar show, which became Young Frankenstein. The Sid Caesar show was one of those shows which pioneered team writing, of which many, many people emerged, Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, and many others. So in a way, it's a bit of history. It's the timing is so marvellous, you know, the verbal and physical timing. And congratulations to the cast for really pulling it off at an American show. So slickly. I just think it all slots very satisfyingly into place. It all slots into place. And there's a marvellous, I shouldn't have forgotten to mention, of course, and that's the Frankenstein's monster, Shula Hensley, who is, again, pitch perfect. It just gets the tone right. It gets the musical precision right. And it just works well all together. I think it's a very, you know that if you're going to Young Frankenstein, you're going to have a very enjoyable evening or matinee out.
I'm told that Mel Brooks thinks this is a much better production than the original, partly perhaps because it's changed and learned from it. Because the original production actually didn't run that long on Broadway. It actually ran for just over a year. And apparently, I mean, the critical reception wasn't as good as it was here. I mean, here we found Michael Billington giving it 5 stars in The Guardian, which I was quite amazed by. But it didn't have the same critical reception there. It didn't run terribly long there. Certainly not anywhere near as long as his other show, The Producers, did. But he's sort of gone on record as saying that he thinks he's very well served by his cast here, and he feels that the show has improved. The Swedish Blonde is interesting because that appears to be almost like a running gag for him, because, of course, there was a Swedish Blonde in The Producers as well. So I think it's one of his signatures, perhaps. So, John, what did you think?
Well, it's strange for me to be bringing up the rear and being possibly the one of the three of us who liked this show the best. I went with fairly low expectations, and I have to say I was partly prejudiced against a couple of things in the cast, and those prejudices were very happily dispersed. So I think it might be too early for pantomime, but it's never too soon to go and see this. It is an ingenious updating. And I love the way that Mel Brooks has not just respected his original creation, but freshened it as a spoof both of the horror movie genre, which of course it already was, but now of the theatricality of stage musicals. So I found it ingenious, funny, clever, corny, and as you've said, mostly served by an excellent cast headed by Hadley Fraser. And I liked the way that he channeled Gene Wilder, but he has a far finer voice and he's much nimbler in the tap shoes. And the other delight for me was to see again Shula Hensley, you know, much praised for playing Judd Fry in the National Theatre's Oklahoma. And since then, for me, for far too long, missed from the West End. And I thought he gave the creature a heart and a soul. And that whole extended putting on the Ritz routine, which framed him with a fantastic chorus line from this really inexhaustible ensemble, I thought was really spot on and an advance from my memory of the movie, because, you know, as we've discussed, it's more than 40 years since the movie. So most of the audience are coming to this brand new. The 2007 Broadway production wasn't very happy and went on tour and sank without trace, but from which this has been recreated and improved. So I think that even for those people to whom Young Frankenstein is a classic, there is a real pleasure in recognising the old jokes which have come up freshly laundered and spotting the new material, which I think is expertly crafted by Mel Brooks himself. We know that Brooks is the keenest observer of vaudeville routines, and there are so many knowing gags bolted into this show that I loved it just for that. Just the staging is deliberately like a 15 backcloth pantomime. I thought that was superb, especially as that's not a genre that an American creative like Mel Brooks could be expected to know intimately. And all the running gags are great, and the lovely knowing references, just sight gags on the scenery, like a lecture is at Anthony and Johns Hopkins University, which I thought was wonderful conflation. And the ship that somebody sails on is the SS Queen Mary Shelley. It's just clever. And also underpinning this whole production, you have a reunited team from the producers. You know, not only do you have William Ivy Long's lovely costumes, I mean, some of those dresses for Summer Stralin are really, really gorgeous. You have Susan Stroman's really firm directorial and choreographic hand, which means that there's a great deal of quality alongside what is unashamedly bushels of corn. So I think all the ingredients are intact, you know, the Gothic location, the eerie castle, the villagers with torches and pitchforks. And then you wonder, I wondered whether Ross Noble, as a very experienced stand-up and television comedian, would really bring his game to this piece. And in a way, I thought he did it as well as Rufus Hound did Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, an unexpected piece of very clever, very physical comedy, and a very sustained and consistent performance all the way through. I really think he's done an excellent job, and I don't know him as a stage actor, but he definitely deserves to have other stage roles if he wants them. Miss Stralin, well, she has so much to send up. She has the theatricality of the show. She has the notional idea of a leggy blonde leading lady. And she has the fact that she is part of this extraordinary troupe of sisters. And she sends them all up. She really does make herself an object of amusement throughout the show. And you could say that the sort of overripe Germanic flirting is really almost too outrageous, but she does a very good job. And of course, her singing is effortless. And then the other one that I was convinced I wouldn't like was Leslie Joseph. I have seen some work that she has done, particularly in sort of provincial touring, using comedies that have been more or less built around her personal talents and her historic character of Dorian Green in Birds of a Feather. But I have to say, she brought her best game to this as well, and definitely staring down any suggestions that she might be past it. So she makes the horses neigh, and she definitely makes the audiences cackle. And not just in the way that they're seeing somebody famous that they know from the television. I think she really did carry it off. She's not Cloris Leachman, and she doesn't have every subtlety that perhaps a more conventional musical comedy actress might have brought to the role, particularly perhaps someone who was more in her 50s than in her 70s. But she definitely delivers. And perhaps because it is something of a pantomime and she has a lot of pantomime experience. But she's high energy and she's playing 8 shows a week. And I don't think that is a bad thing at all. So it is a panto, really, isn't it? I mean, it's the best panto you'll see before Christmas, or since it's just renewed to next September, very possibly before next Christmas. So yes, I liked it.
We're now going to talk about Young Marx at the Bridge Theatre, which is new. The Bridge Theatre is a theatre set up by Nicholas Heitner and Nick Starr. They were the team when Nicholas Heitner was artistic director at the National Theatre. Nick Starr was his sort of executive producer. They've set up this new theatre just right next to Tower Bridge.
And it's certainly a rather impressive building, although I did find a few faults with it, which is bad signage. I had to guess where my seats were because there was no signs telling you where to go. My ticket was several months old, didn't say the same things on it that the signs when you eventually found them did. And the cheap row of seats I got in, which are these perch seats, which they also now have at the Dorfman Theatre. The difference is at the Dorfman Theatre, you can actually sort of perch and people can get past you. In these seats, nobody can get past you, which means you physically have to almost empty an entire row if somebody comes in late and they are some way down the row. So it's a very, very bad design in those terms, and it shows a certain amount of thoughtlessness on the part of the theatre. Obviously, this is a new theatre and will be teething problems, and they will start putting signs up, and even if it spoils the overall look of the foyer. Anyway, the play here is Young Marx, which is written by Richard Bean and Clive Coleman, and directed by Nicholas Heitner, with designed by Mark Thompson. It stars Rory Kinnear as Karl Marx, with Oliver Chris as Friedrich Engels, Nancy Carroll as Jenny von Westphalen, Laura Elphinstone as Helene DeMuth, and also includes people such as Nicholas Burns, Tony Jayawardena, Miltos Yerulemu, and William Troughton, Fodi Simbu, Sophie Russell, Alana Ramsey, Eben Figueredo, Scott Karim, Joseph Wilkins, and Duncan Wisby. It is about the life of Karl Marx. We're about in 1849, 1850. It's just after the big revolutions in Europe in 1848, when quite a lot of Europe suffered almost simultaneous revolutions, and some countries were brought down, other countries, you got a reaction from the powers that be, and the revolutions were quashed rather violently in some cases. This never actually happened in Britain, and pretty much every radical leftist in Europe ended up migrating to Britain. And one of those people was Karl Marx, who, along with Friedrich Engels, had published the Communist Manifesto at this point. And Karl Marx is now very poor. We first meet him trying to pawn a silver gravy jug. And he is trying to work on his big work, which will eventually be Das Kapital. And he is sponging off his good friend Friedrich Engels, who is the son of a rather rich cotton manufacturer in Manchester. Alice, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
I had very, very mixed feelings about this, I have to say. It is a farce, and one has to take it as a farce. I've got a sense of humour, you know, both bourgeois and proletariat. I just thought it was a curious choice for the first production. I mean, obviously, perhaps Clive Coleman isn't so well known. He's the ex-BBC legal correspondent. But Richard Bean is, of course, known internationally, including in America. It just felt as a very curious beginning, because for me, although the story does insert details which are specific to Karl Marx and the Marx household and its economy, as you've said, about the straitened circumstances of the Marx family, but, you know, it lasted 2 hours and 20 minutes, and I really did wonder if other famous people could have been inserted in the named eponymous subject and the loose and fast facts, and I have to put that in quotes, it could have been changed with really very, very little difficulty. You know, there were times when I did think, wait a minute, there's one great moment in a way on the marvellous set designed by Mark Thompson, a revolving set, which there was a rooftop chase. But then I did think, oh, this is a bit Bill Sykes-y. And there was even a kind of tiny Tim. I mean, it is true that Karl Marx and his wife did have a small child who died, but it sort of became like it could be a kind of tiny Tim. And you even have, taking from Dickens's life, a bit on the side in the maid. Maybe that's a bit un-PC to say a bit on the side. I mean, she was a bit more than that. But you have the maid who, it is alleged in this production, fathered Karl Marx's child. I have to say, I'm being very picky about this because that's not proven. I wouldn't normally maybe even put this when I'm talking about a show because I would feel it was a tiny bit of a spoiler maybe. But in this case, it actually goes a bit against the historical fact. It's unproven, and a lot of people might go away thinking, oh yeah, that Karl Marx, he fathered this kid. I mean, obviously it is drama, and one accepts that there can be a bit of fiction put in. But I wasn't that keen on that side of things either. It's perfectly well acted. It's perfectly enjoyable if you enjoy a kind of sitcom type humour. But it struck me as more of a series of sketches, kind of League of Marxist Gentlemen. It was given pace by Nicholas Heitner's direction, and especially the music of Grant Olding. I can't say that I found it particularly hilarious or side-splitting or insightful. I guess it did gallop through a few of the proven facts of Marx's life. But, I mean, the one point, which was quite early on when I thought maybe there would be something a bit more substantial when a whelk stall comes on in a kind of Python-esque episode, and we get told the whole economic chain of how this whelk stall is supplied. And obviously there's a lot of contracting out, and it was done very well, and it was very funny. But then nothing came of it. So you really had something which was, I have to say, a template for a sitcom. I mean, this is what I felt, that you could insert other famous people, especially Dickens, into that framework without much trouble. As I said, it was all very well done to a certain extent, and people were laughing, although I noticed that some people remained stony-faced around me. The children, I don't actually know who I saw on the night, but you have playing little Jenny, who plays the piano on stage. There are three kids alternating, Dixie Edgerix, Matilda Shapland, or Harriet Turnbull, and little Forksy, who unfortunately dies in the end, Logan Clark, Rupert Turnbull, or Joseph Walker. The kids were very, very good. And of course, I'm not really downplaying the actors, who were all perfectly slick. But the idea of Friedrich Engels and Marx as this sort of music hall double act, it just felt a bit tired, to be honest. You know, we know that kind of humour, and I was waiting for the twist that never came. It's serviceable. I don't know whether it's a particularly auspicious start, but there looks to be a very interesting programme in future productions. You've got a Promenade Julius Caesar coming up, and Barney Norris, who's a very talented young writer, who I think we've all seen several of his plays already, has got a new play on the cards. It's a lovely theatre. You enter the foyer and it's very spacious. There's also a lot of ladies' toilets, which I have to say is always a plus. But it was a little bit lacklustre as a first production.
What did you think, Gareth?
I'm more positive than Alice. In fact, I'm a lot more positive than Alice. And I had a very enjoyable evening. I'm a big fan of Richard Bean, so it's good to see a Richard Bean play. In particular, I think he is great with humour. And I think one of the things I liked about this play is that even though I studied European history from 1814 to 1939, up until I was 18, I really didn't know anything about the sort of revolutions in Europe and the revolutionary exiles in London, really. So it kind of opened my eyes a bit. It was telling me things that were happening I didn't know about. And Engels, for example, was fascinating. I didn't understand that Engels was a German mill owner living in Manchester who was a sort of secret commie and a sort of benefactor of Marx. So I enjoyed learning about something I didn't know anything about that was clearly an interesting period leading up to his writing of Das Kapital. And I found the story very true. I mean, Francis Wien, who's Karl Marx's biographer, or has written a biography of Karl Marx, says
that all of this is absolutely true, that they lived this sort of manic life, and he was very poor and so on, and he was a bit of a philanderer. So, I mean, it is a true story. It is, for me, a very interesting story, and I thought it was very entertainingly told. I wouldn't call it farce. It was often farcical, but I wouldn't actually call it farce. I think that it's got a lovely sort of pace to it, and there are some nice running jokes about the early days of the police. Charles Darwin turns up in a lovely cameo in the British Library. And some of the political views seem very fresh, really. They're views that we're hearing now, post-2008, from not just left-wing people, but also from other disaffected people like me. So I thought it was very entertaining, and I enjoyed it very much. I thought that Mark Thompson had built a very clever revolving structure that moves from living room to pub to pawnbrokers to British Library reading room and so on. I thought that even though it had great pace, it didn't seem rushed to me. And it does take quite a dark turn towards the end. So it ends a lot more gently and a lot more thoughtfully than most of it. I think that Rory Kinnear's performance is very athletic. I mean, he does have very good comic timing, although we're probably more used to seeing him in serious roles, but it's a very athletic performance. I was sitting in the front row, and there was a moment when he was climbing up this structure where I was genuinely fearing for his safety. It seemed to me to be a very athletic way to do it. Nancy Carroll, of course, one of my favourites, is superb as Jenny, whose loyalty is tested. And Oliver Chris, who's someone we began to see quite a bit of, continues to impress for me. His chemistry with Rory Kinnear, he plays Engels, his chemistry with Rory Kinnear's Marks was very strong. And there's a lovely performance by Laura Elphinstone, who's the servant Nim, who Marx does bed. And then you've got some of these lovely but difficult to pronounce names. Eben Figuero, Miltus Yerolyemu, and Tony J. Wadena, who have these great cameos as Schramm and Barthelemy and Schmidt, respectively. So I thought, you know, putting together the team that were responsible for probably London's biggest comedy hit, One Man, Two Governors, to launch a new theatre, was a good idea. And I think both the show and the theatre were a big success. I didn't use the toilets. I felt the foyer needed a bit more seating. I also found it difficult to find my way to the seats because the signage wasn't particularly good. But, you know, this was the first week of a new theatre. I'd been back there for a concert, so I've now seen it in two different settings. And I think it's sitting there on the riverbank with the most stunning view. I just think it's a great new place for London. I'm looking forward to both Julius Caesar and the Barney Norris play, both of which I booked for, to see it in the different configurations. So a welcome for both play and the theatre. Did you enjoy the play, Tim?
Yeah, quite a lot. I mean, obviously you can see the flaws in it. It's not by any means a perfect play. I was reminded quite a lot by the cycle of plays that Tom Stoppard did. It must be 10, 15 years ago now. The Coast of Utopia, where he very much concentrated on the Russian revolutionaries. And the Russian revolutionaries, people like Herzen and others, who, again, ended up in London after the big revolutions of 1848, along with all the Italian revolutionaries and the French revolutionaries, and indeed German revolutionaries. This did introduce me to some interesting ideas. I had no idea about Jenny von Westphalen, and I'd really not looked into her and her history and the fact that her brother was head of the Prussian Secret Service, essentially, and was one of the people whose object was to hunt Marx down and kill him. And she was, of course, married to Karl Marx. It's a rather interesting point of view. They do make a few hand-wavy things about the children. The child called Forksy was actually one when he died. They did have another son who died young, I think died at about 11, a few years later than this. And also he had, I think, two or three girls at the time. Only two of his girls survived to adulthood. It was very bad like that. I mean, certainly there is this kind of Dickensian reference because, you know, we are in peak Dickens. This is the time, I mean, he was writing, Dickens was actually just published, I think, David Copperfield at the time this is written. Obviously, you know, he'd been writing for 10 years and had written Oliver Twist and Christmas Carol. So we are going to always feel his hand in anything set around this period, I think. There is always going to be that possibility. And especially when you're talking about people living in poverty, which obviously, I think they might be over-egging the poverty a little bit, but it's probably reasonably accurate. He did end up rather rich. If I remember rightly, they made some rather, or he or Engels made some rather astute real estate purchases, you know, property, got into property in London, and he died a reasonably well-off man, having only really written a couple of books and a couple of treatises. He did end up earning quite a lot, and it's a rather interesting thing for a man who is held up as this great paragon. I too went to the Wikipedia and checked on the whole thing of whether or not he may have bedded his housekeeper come secretary in the character of Nim. It is one of those things which is alleged and you're not sure of the truth of it, because you can't quite work out whether people are protecting Marx because they love him or people are attacking Marx because they hate him. So you can't really get to the final truth of the matter. Certainly, it probably wasn't Engels who fathered her child. And she certainly had a child about this period. So whether or not it was Marx's child is debatable. Although they certainly looked after her, although it was Engels who ended up having to pay her and claim paternity. I mean, obviously, they just turned it into fun. When you think of Marx, you can not only think of Karl Marx, you also think of Groucho, Chico, Harpo and Zeppo, you know, the Marx brothers. So it's introducing a little bit of that kind of farcical element into it and that kind of humour into it. I thought Rory Kinnear, always impressive. It's always nice to read on Twitter when people are finding out about Rory Kinnear and how good he is, and even if it's for the first time. I mean, remember, I think it must be almost 15 years ago now that I first saw him, so I always think people ought to be catching up with the quality of Rory Kinnear. I always think Nancy Carroll, anytime she's playing the wife and relegated to not being that important, it's always a waste of her considerable talents, but she's very good in this. Oliver Chris is very good, and Laura Elphinstone is good, and I liked the supporting people in it. It's a decent enough play. I could see that all the flaws, and it does drag a little bit. I was not surprised when one or two people didn't come back after the interval. They weren't really happy with it, certainly in my rather difficult to get to row. It was fun, and I look forward to seeing what they're going to do at the theatre. Hopefully they're going to improve things, and I think I'm going to be standing up for the Julius Caesar.
I'd like to add one positive about the theatre, if I may, which is that the programmes are now probably, if they're all going to be like that, the best in London. I thought the programme was fantastic because it had four or five really, really interesting essays that you could read after you saw the show. So I thought that was another bonus too.
The reason why I say it's very template-ish as well, I mean, I felt as if it didn't really mine some of the humour that it was possible to mine from Marx's life. I mean, there was a bit made of him as being, and he is commonly thought of as the Jew Karl Marx. He was, in fact, a baptized Lutheran. And, you know, I mean, you could have had a really corny joke, running joke all the way through where people were calling him the Jew and he was coming back, no, I'm not, I'm Lutheran, or something. It didn't really feel as if it was terribly honed towards Marx. Yes, of course, there were particular details that were put in, but the overall structure of the play, it felt as if it could have been any famous person living in the 19th century at that time who was of that persuasion. I mean, obviously, Dickens and Marx are probably the two best known. If you wanted to put Charles Booth in, but nobody would have heard of him. He did a map of poverty in London where he put all the areas in black and red. I just felt like this was very much a formula and, in a way, a missed opportunity.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.